Welcome to Sports Business Secrets. I'm your host, Kevin Tarka. This podcast is specifically designed to share secrets from experts in the sports business world to help you along your own path to success in this industry. Each episode is packed with lessons and insights that never expire. You'll hear from general managers of professional teams to CEOs of sports tech companies to agents, coaches, players, and everything in between. I invite you to join me in real time on my personal journey of representing players and coaches, traveling the world, and always finding a way to battle through obstacles in this competitive industry. Duncan, welcome to Sports Business Secrets.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you having me.
It's great to have you here. So on this podcast, we like to dive behind the scenes and share some sports business and life secrets with the audience that they can't find online. Now, I've always said that if you ask 20 different agents about their background and strategy, you'll likely get 20 different answers. And I actually went back and counted, not quite at 20 here, but I have had 12 guests who are either currently or formerly agents on the pod. And so far we've gotten 12 different answers. So I don't think it will be any different today. I'm excited to share more about your background and dive into some hot topics here today in the agent industry.
Sounds like fun.
So I will give a brief little background here and then I'll give you the stage. So for those who are unaware, Duncan is a UPenn graduate who went on to get his law degree at Temple University. He then practiced law in various capacities from technology-based transactions to intellectual property rights. Then he spent some time defending the city of Philadelphia in discrimination lawsuits. I'm sure I missed a lot of the law details in there, but as of course, as we will discuss today, he's also been involved in the athlete representation business for about 15 years, give or take. He's currently MBPA and FIBA certified, and he has clients who play here in the States in the NBA. He's placed players in various continents around the world. And so Duncan is here to share his story and tell us more about the lovely world of being a sports agent.
I appreciate it. Well, I'm a Philly guy, born and bred, lived here my entire life, high school here, college here, law school here. I'm still barred in Pennsylvania and New Jersey from that previous lifetime of mine that you just referred to. I've been an agent in some capacity since law school. So since 2008 or 2009, somewhere in there, there was no model. I didn't have a mentor. I didn't have a dad or an uncle in this line of work. It's kind of hard for me to really pinpoint what kind of planted that seed or lit that fire in me, other than I always was around the game. I wasn't really that good as a player, but I had friends who were pretty good. And as they played in college and, I palled around, I had season tickets when I was at Penn and as an undergrad. And then at law school, I went to all the games. Fran Dunphy was the coach at Penn when I was there. And then I like to say Fran just follows me everywhere I go. Obviously, it's the opposite. I'll follow Fran to the end of the earth and back. He's the best. But then when I went to Temple for law school, he was up there on North Broad Street coaching Temple's team after replacing John Chaney, who had retired. So I was just always around the game because I knew I loved it. I loved the competition. I loved the culture. A lot of that is like Iverson driven as a 12, 13, 14 year old in Philly. It was just something that I knew I had to be around, even as I became a young adult. So during my first year of law school, this would have been 07, 08, Temple's men's team practiced right across the street from the law school. And I would just go to those practices. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't really have any idea why I was going to those practices, but I just wanted to hang out with Sean Trice and Dave Duke and Franny and all those guys. And I don't even really remember, but at a certain point I'd be in my khakis. I'd be dressed like I'm dressed today, like the kind of nerdy guy that I am. And guys would start to come up to me thinking I was a coach or like a friend or whatever. And I said, I'm kind of none of those things. I'm just a law student across the street. I worship in the Cathedral of Dunphy. I'm really just here to kind of follow him around and just kind of bathe in his light a little bit. So they would start picking my brain about contract and international law. And what do you think of this? And what do you think of that? And I don't have any explanation as to why that started, but that was kind of the genesis. That was the beginning of, I want to try to help very talented people reach their maximum potential, both from a competition level and a compensation level. And you know that it's not like that was a light switch that went off and then the next day I became an agent. This is a 2 and 3 and 4 year process, but that's kind of the beginning of it. And you know, the anecdote that I give young men that I'm recruiting, or that we're recruiting, I should say, and their families, is that what is a little interesting about my family, I have one older sister, my sister Kate, who lives up in New York, and she does this exact same line of work, but for book authors. So there's just like something in us. There's like something genetically wired that like wants to get into this representation and advocacy work. So you know, she is Kate is like a super duper star in terms of the folks that she works with and all the great stuff that she's doing. And I'm just kind of you know, small potatoes compared to her. But as I said, there's something in Kate and I that I guess was kind of genetically predisposed to get into this line of work. So that's how I got started. And I want to kind of cool my jets here and cool it down and turn it back to you, Kevin.
That's awesome. No, I appreciate that background. And like I said, everyone else always has a different upbringing, but it sounded like for you, that dream, you know, you loved playing, but that dream to play in the NBA kind of faded pretty quickly, right? And so you know, choosing your
Very
co
quickly. It faded very quickly. Yes.
So choosing your college was almost entirely based on academics and what you wanted to study and, you know, where you wanted to live and things of that nature. So, but it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, like people started picking your brain about contract law and maybe international law. Like, was that really the point that, you know, obviously you said it was a process, but, you know, that something clicked to where like, hey, you know, my expertise in contracts or in law, like really can make an impact or actually has something to do with this sport that I happen to have a passion for.
No question about it. And, you know, excuse me, I get asked from time to time, do you have to go to law school? Do you have to be a barred attorney to be a good sports agent? And the answer is definitely no. There are plenty of agents that are not also lawyers, but I can say it definitely helps. It definitely buttresses your credentials. It buttresses your confidence. You know, just be able to like draft and read and think and analyze critically. Those are tools in your tool chest that get really, really sharp in law school. So they definitely help being an attorney. And I think practicing, you know, I tried 10 and 12 cases in front of judges and in front of juries, state court, federal court. All of those are part and parcel to, I think, the confidence that you need in your persuasion, in your advocacy. And I do think they are skills that really help being a good sports agent, but they're not, you know, they're not, you know, indisposable. They're not prerequisites to being a good agent.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge. And I'm glad you said that because I'm sure you get the questions as well. But a lot of athletes that might be listening to this or prospects, if you will, you know, who's the perfect agent? What, you know, what background should you look for? There's not a perfect agent, right? You know, you can have an excellent career being represented by someone who's never been to law school and an excellent career being represented by someone who has. But I definitely agree because obviously I did not go to law school. And you know, I think that there are things that I could improve personally with the confidence and actually, you know, understanding the contract law to a degree to where you're going to stand up in front of a judge and know what you're talking about. Do you need that every single day if you're negotiating a contract with a team in Hungary? Maybe not, but it doesn't hurt, right? So,
It
but
definitely doesn't. It doesn't hurt, A, to have that confidence in yourself, and hopefully by osmosis, your client and their family have that confidence in you. But another analogy I give from time to time is sometimes you need to be a shield for your client, and sometimes you need to be a sword. And to say that you are a licensed attorney, that can be a very helpful sword if a team, if management is trying to pinch your client or pay them late, or essentially not give them what you negotiated for during the draft of the contract and so on and so forth. So I have found that that can be a pretty persuasive threat is kind of the wrong word. It's a fact, right? I don't need to outsource this FIBA bat case to some other person. I can get this case off the ground in the next 48 hours if you don't comply with the clauses in our contract. Now hop to it. You know, that can be
yeah.
forceful when you have some experience both in arbitration and in court.
Yeah, for sure. And a couple of those topics you mentioned, we're going to get into here shortly. But first, so let's jump into the agent talk. Obviously, you know, you had some experience throughout the 15 years of the agent business and it, with other companies doing different roles. But now we have DML Limited. DML Limited, correct? So tell the audience about your company. Just describe a little bit about the types of clients that you represent. And then I'll dive into specific questions from there.
So when I initially got going, I was on my own, and to sign clients when you are on your own with no experience, that is a very narrow needle that you need to thread. So I didn't sign anybody for the first year or two of recruiting because I'd give this big pitch and how well I know your game and I know your coach and I know your mom and this, that, and the third. And the players would say, the prospective clients would say, I love all this. This is great. You seem like a nice enough guy, but like, have you ever done this before? Like, what is your track record of success? And it's like, well, I don't have any. I want to start with you. That fell on its face for about 2 years, right? As I'm, contacting Division II schools, Division III schools, trying to find players that might not be getting hit up by, 30 and 40 agents to kind of get this thing off the ground. Eventually, two or three guys say, okay, essentially nobody else is recruiting me, so I guess, what do I have to lose here? Two or three guys had some success. The next year, you build off that success, two or three more guys, and then by maybe 3 or 4, you're 3 or 4 of, guys signing with you, you start to see a little bit more success. Success begets success, right? So like that process was probably a like 5 or 6 year process for me, or 4 or 5 year process. I then joined up with a European-based agency, and that was fine, but they had a pretty defined ceiling, is the best way I would describe it. I then joined up with another American guy, and that didn't work out for a variety of reasons. But in terms of DML Limited, I've got four folks working for me here in Philadelphia in various capacities: scouting, recruiting, social media content, reports, scouting reports. But at the end of the day, I am the president. I'm the CEO. My name is the one that's on the contracts, along with the players, obviously. And I'm the one who is MBPA certified, FIBA certified, and NCAA certified. And that is by design. It's not like I'm a control freak. I've just been doing this long enough that I think I have a pretty clear sense at this point, in terms of what works and what doesn't. And I want the buck to stop with me. I want to be accountable if something goes right, and I want to be accountable if something goes wrong and get into problem-solving mode. So that's the structure of our agency now, and I'm really happy with that. That's not to say we might grow or we might branch out or partner up with somebody in the future, but as it stands here in March 2024, I'm really happy with where things are and also where they're going.
That's great. So 2 points off of that excellent intro that you just gave for your company. So one is apologies because I think I forgot to mention before the third license that you hold, which is NCAA, because I know I mentioned MBPA and FIBA, but also NCAA certified. So first, can you just quickly differentiate between the three for the audience who might not be aware of what those three mean?
Sure. So the NBPA is just the players, the NBA Players Union. They're the ones that oversee the credentialing and the licensing of agents. And what you need to do to get your MBA license, you need to, pay some fees, you need to go to a couple of classes, and then you need to pass a agent exam. It's a 50 question, 60 question. Maybe it's a, I think it's a 60 question exam that you have to get 50 right, or 50 questions that you have to get 40 right. It's offered every year. But in order to be an agent that can actually sign a contract between an NBA team and an NBA player, you have to be certified by the NBPA. So the NBPA certification is for what I would call the domestic players, the NBA and G League players. The FIBA certification, FIBA is the international governing body over all of the international leagues. Australia, Italy, Japan, and anywhere and everywhere in between, they all fall under the umbrella and supervision of FIBA. I am so old that I actually waved into my FIBA license, whatever it was, 13 or 14 years ago, because I'm a licensed attorney. I don't think you can still do that anymore. All I'm saying is I never sat for a FIBA exam. That was not a requirement when I applied for my FIBA license, however many years ago that was. But that is what a FIBA license is. You cannot be on a contract between an international team and a player unless you are also FIBA licensed. So that's kind of what I would call the licensing that you need for international players. So NCAA certification just came about in the last 2 years, 3 years, I guess this is its fourth year. So it came about 3 years ago. And that allows agents who sit for an exam and pay for some fees, and I actually have to carry liability insurance and so on and so forth. There are a lot of requirements that go into the NCAA agent certification. But what it allows you to do is sign NCAA players that still have eligibility left. It does not, they don't care about guys who, I guess with COVID, it's 5 years now, but usually, you know, guys that have exhausted their 4 years of NCAA eligibility, or if they redshirt a fifth year, whatever else, they don't care about those guys. They can't come back, their eligibility is gone. But for guys that, you know, just finished their freshman year or sophomore year and have 1 or 2 or 3 years of NCAA eligibility left, you can sign with an NCAA certified agent to test the waters of Portsmouth, of Chicago, of pre-draft workouts. I won't go into all the details now, but there are a couple of dates that you have to be mindful of in terms of when you can and when you can't sign with an agent. And then also when you have to declare for the draft, i.e., then the testing the waters process starts, and then when you have to withdraw from the draft. And if you don't withdraw by a certain date, your NCAA eligibility is extinguished. But in a certain way, you know, I was happy to, I just got NCAA certified this past year. And I was okay with that. I could have applied, you know, a couple of years ago, but I really wanted to like get the pre-draft process really down. And like, Kevin, it's not like what we do is rocket science, but like it really is its own weird esoteric world that even like NCAA one coaches don't know that much about. When I talk to coaches, they're like, oh, I'm sorry, what is that date? And when can you do this? And that's not nothing to, you know, take away from coaches. It's just that we really need to know this very strange NBA, G League, and overseas world inside and out before I feel like you can give really credible, really sound advice to young men that really have a lot at stake. Because if you F that up, pardon my French, and their eligibility is gone, now they've got a problem. So I really wanted to get that process down cold before I applied for NCAA certification. And I feel like at this point, in terms of the testing the waters process, that is something that I know inside and out really, really well. And at this point, I'm happy to, and I hope to sign a couple of young men that still have NCAA eligibility left here in the coming weeks to help them test the waters and see where that goes and go from there.
That's great. That's a great breakdown. While we're on the topic of testing the waters, what have you found that teams are looking for that? So let's say a guy's you know, not on the top 10 draft board picks, right? They're a prospect. They've raised some eyebrows. Maybe they're getting conference honors, right? And they make a run in their conference tournament or the NCAA tournament, and they're potential NBA players, but they're obviously an underclassman. What have you found that really moves the needle for NBA teams when a player is testing the waters? Like, what are they looking for? Because as you and I both know, and maybe not all the audience knows, scouts at the next level are looking for what's wrong with a player, right? They're not really just out there saying, hey, this guy could be good potentially if he does this. They're saying, hey, look, oh, he can't dribble left, or he can't shoot in this circumstance. So what have you found from your experience that moves the needle for guys that should test the waters? And I guess the follow-up would be like, what would be a reason for guys not to test the waters?
Let me be very clear on this point. NCAA, NBA teams are incredibly, incredibly, incredibly picky and particular about who they want and why they want them. Let's just put the first round guys over in this pile over here. If you just have that much talent, the path will be relatively straightforward for you. Let's move into the like 60 and 61st pick type guys, right? The guys that are either fringe draft guys or like night of the draft, two-way E10, you know, partially guaranteed guys, right? NBA teams at that level, where it's not, we're building a team around you. It is more, you need to be an absolutely perfect specialist at what you are. It's two things: perfect specialist in the whatever 3-and-D mold, Walker Kessler shot blocking mold. You've got to be a great specialist at what you do, because the, you know, it's a poorly kept secret is that the NBA is like another 80-20 example. 20% of the guys are, you know, teams that or guys that teams get built around and are playing 35 minutes a night. 80% of NBA players are incredibly specialized role players. Incredibly specialized role players, right? So if you are taking the 20% out of our conversation because they're first round picks, they're lottery picks, teams are going to get built around them by the time of their second contract. Teams are looking for very specific things where a great fit for the Utah Jazz makes absolutely no sense for the Brooklyn Nets. So you've got to do a really good job as an agent and as a player, A, aligning those expectations, and then B, thinking really strategically about roster fit and about where that person with this really specific skill set and specialty could be a fit, right? I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. Like, you know, a team that has a lot of young athletic wings, the Orlando Magic, let's say, that might not be a great fit to try to do a second or third pre-draft workout for your 6'6 wing who's also 21 and trying to get his foot at the door, right? You've got to do a much better job thinking about, you know, coaching staff, styles of play, and just roster construction generally. When you only have 15 roster spots plus three two-ways, this is not an unlimited universe of, you know, you can just go here, here, or here. When you are a 60 or 61st pick type player, you've got to be very strategic about the organizations that you really want to get aggressive with. You should be aggressive with all 30 organizations, obviously. But in terms of really turning the heat up, you've got to be able to speak with substance and persuasion to a select grouping of NBA teams where that player with that skill set can be a specific fit given their current roster construction, and also, you know, how that fits among their draft picks and free agency and who's coming in and who's going out and so on and so forth. So that's a big part of what we do, because our business model is not to recruit top 5 picks, top 10 picks, top 15 picks. The guys that we recruit are the 60 and 61st pick guys. So we take a lot of pride in our relationships with NBA front offices, G League front offices, so we can have really truthful, candid conversations about fit and construction about players like that.
Yeah, that's great. And the next thing I want to get into was the pre-draft process. Before I, you know, I'm just writing notes here. Before we talk about the business model, which you mentioned as well. So the pre-draft process, and obviously testing the waters could be part of that. You know, you're testing the waters and then you could choose to actually leave or go back to school. But I want to talk a bit more about the pre-draft process of, let's just say somebody decides to leave, or they've exhausted their eligibility and you're a senior and you're preparing to go for some NBA workouts and you've chosen your agency. What, because I think the pre-draft process can get overhyped, not that you shouldn't be focused on it because it's the most important part for you to prepare for your next step of your career. But talk about the pre-draft process, maybe about what you do, like the expenses of the pre-draft process, where players go, like should players be expecting to go live in a penthouse in Miami and have everything paid for, or you know, should you go stay at your college because you're used to the strength coach and they want to put you through a program? Like what's your mindset on the pre-draft process?
Be as aggressive as possible and get in front of NBA decision makers as frequently as possible. Even though in my last example, the Orlando Magic might not be the best fit for a 3-year deal down the line. Because we recruit and sign and represent the 60th and 61st pick guys, it really doesn't behoove you, in my experience, to be cute. And by cute, I mean, oh, that guy from Baylor or Texas Tech or Oregon is going to be at that workout. I don't think we're going to match up well with that guy. Let's shut that down and wait for our next opportunity. Other agencies might feel differently about that. The guys that we sign and recruit, it's like, you know, it's like the Jason Kelsey quote from yesterday, right? It's like the hungriest dogs run faster, right? It's like, these are guys that are looking to break through, and I can ruin the surprise for everybody right now. No one falls ass backwards into the NBA, all right? You have to really earn that and beat out a lot of other very talented players to get to that level and earn your role and earn your spot at that level. So if you want to, you know, turn down workouts or turn down Portsmouth or turn down the G League Elite Camp or the Combine, you do so at your own peril, because NBA teams and executives and decision makers and coaches know that competitors are the ones that actually make it in the NBA. The guys that love the work, the guys that love the practice. Why is Michael Jordan here and Ben Simmons there, right? It's not that complicated. So in that way, When we work with young men, we try to get as many pre-draft workouts with NBA teams on the table as possible. We try to get them to Portsmouth. We try to get them to the G League Elite Camp in Chicago or the Combine in Chicago, and then all of June, getting to as many workouts with NBA teams before the draft in late June as possible. To answer your question directly, we stopped doing the cookie cutter, let's just fly the six guys that we've signed this spring to Tempe, to LA, to Tampa, whatever. The trainers are already down there. And from 9 to 3, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you're doing this. And from 2 to 4 on Tuesdays and Thursdays, you're doing this. It's not bad. I don't hate that model. What we've learned over time is that different young men need different things. Some guys will say, I have 6 more credits I need to finish, and my parents will shoot me in the face if I don't graduate. I need to stay on campus. Okay, no problem, right? In that case, we'll get you some NBA balls. We'll ship you up a pair of sneaks. We will work very closely with your current coaching staff, or if you have trainers in the area, if we need to get a trainer to your area, that's fine, but finish out with your books. That is crucially important. Other guys will say, I went to school in whatever, Illinois. I am from whatever, Montana, Boston, Philadelphia, anywhere. My AAU guy or my high school coach has been getting me right every summer for the last 7 summers. I don't want to mess that up. I am the player that I am today that you recruited because of John Smith, AAU coach. Awesome. In that case, let me call John Smith, make sure we're on the same page, make sure he's got availability and he's taken care of and so on and so forth. And then, you know, you get back with him and line it up. The third option in our shop, which is probably the most commonly tracked or selected option among guys that we sign, is we have an entire list of trainers and facilities that we use and work with around the country. What we do is we put options on the table for these guys. We talk about the trainers. We talk about the facilities, the pros, the cons of both. We get them on the phone with those people, and we make sure that player X, who doesn't know trainer Y and is just going off of our suggestion, really has a good vibe and a good feeling and is motivated to go, you know, out of town, to go to Chicago, to go to Philly, to go to Boston, to work out 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 days a week for the next month and 5 weeks. So those are the three kind of paths that we tend to take for pre-draft training. We take care of those expenses, though it's not like we just hand them a blank check. I mean, we need to cost down like any business, but that's part of the process for us. And that tends to be how we work and take care of pre-draft training every spring and every summer for our guys.
Yeah, that's great. And I think I tend to agree. I mean, I think everyone's different. Like you said, it's going to be case by case, but it goes back to the conversation. And in my encouragement or opinion is like, you know, you as a player, you have to just be honest with how you want to be recruited. And that's either going to be a matchup with the agent or not. Like if you're straightforward and say, look, I want to be recruited, like, hey, I don't know, I've been in Montana for 4 years, like I do want to go to Miami and have some of the, you know, nicer weather and work out every day.
I have lost out on the recruiting trail to agencies that say, we will give you a blank check and move you to South Beach. Yeah. And that's okay. Like, we are probably not going to be a good match anyway. That's not our style. And if that's other people's style, like, I don't hate that. Like, South Beach is awesome. I get it. But like, that's not the way we approach our business. But guys match up with agents and agencies for certain reasons. And we are very excited about the guys that we sign and work with every year. And I'm sure the guys that go to South Beach are very excited about their agents. And that's okay too.
Definitely. But as a player, you have to understand that. Don't forget, we continue to use the word business because it is a business like it is for you. You know, it's the same thing for agencies. So if you do, even if you're a high level player and you do go to Miami, understand the cost that it takes to get there. So let's say, you know, it's $20,000 for all the bells and whistles for 2 months of work. Okay. Just for example, you know, ask yourself, well, if I was in the agent's shoes, like, are my contracts going to generate enough commission revenue to cover that $20,000, or am I going to be a big question mark? Am I going to the NBA first round? Am I undrafted? Am I going abroad? Which I want to transition into here shortly, but just understand that, you know, pre-draft process is different for everyone. But it's not just, you know, giving away free money here, because these things do get expensive and there's so many pieces to it.
There's no question about it. And what you're talking about is all about something that we preach in our shop all the time, which is honesty and being objective, but also just like aligning expectations. Don't say that, like, sign with us and we're sending you to South Beach with a blank check if that's not actually what we're doing. And it's not, right? But if you send a list of prospective trainers and facilities, stand by those guys. Make sure they're legit. Make sure that they're ready to work with, you know, Tom Johnson player that you're recruiting, and everyone's ready to rip. You know, you just it's important. There's so much BS that flies around our business and the business of basketball generally. As you are getting a relationship off the ground, and you want that relationship to, at a certain point, get, essentially stand for the following proposition. I know you've never heard of these people, but this team in Japan wants to sign you for this amount of money, and it's 9,000 miles away from home, and trust me, everything's going to be okay. It's a wild thing to say, but that's literally our line of work. And you need the trust level to be there among you and your client and their family for that conversation to be reasonable, and to you know, be truthful. So that starts early in the recruiting process, and you've got to build that trust, and you've got to build that open, honest relationship from day one.
Yep, agreed. Very important. So let's transition a little bit to involving the international landscape. Obviously, we talked about pre-draft, we talked about NCAA stuff and going to the NBA, but the reality is for a lot of guys that if you are going to play at the next level, statistically speaking, you know, you're most likely going to go abroad. Okay. So the majority of guys do. So what does that mean? I mean, we can go for hours and hours here, but maybe we'll compartmentalize it to a couple of different topics. And I know one of them you have strong opinions on, just as I do, is, all right, let's start with FIBA. So as an agent, as a FIBA certified agent, maybe if you can just break down, okay, like actually what the business model is. So agents, of course, get a percentage of the contracts, right? Does that mean for you work directly with the network of teams that you know abroad? Or do you go through partners? Have you done both before? I mean, there's so many different models that you can do. But again, back to the important topic of FIBA, it's like it's a different world and you need to know it. And there are things that, you know, FIBA regulates, or let's say doesn't regulate, that makes it more challenging. So maybe you could just kind of, I'll just give you the stage for a little bit to talk about your overall thoughts on, you know, players going abroad, what's important, your thoughts on FIBA, and then I'll kind of dive in and pick questions from there.
Sure. So this would be its own podcast or
Absolutely.
webcast. I will just say that big picture, FIBA, after all of us agents pay FIBA whatever it is, $1,100, $1,200 a year, whatever the conversion rate on Swiss francs is every year, FIBA does a remarkably bad job protecting American agents who have clients overseas. I'll just leave it at that for now, because that could then get me off on a 30 or 45 minute long thing that, like, I don't need to get into. That is unfortunate given the expense of FIBA every year. I don't really rely on FIBA all that much, other than it's a credential that I need for some of these, almost all of these contracts, right? In terms of the business model, it's very straightforward. In the NBA, non-minimum contracts generate a 4% commission for agents, where player pays agent directly. Player is paid $100 on a non-minimum contract for an NBA player. Player pays agent $4, 4%. So player walks away with 96, agent walks away with 4. For minimum contracts and two-way contracts, it is a 2% commission that, again, player pays agent directly. Player gets a $100 salary, pays agent 2, walks away with $98. Overseas, internationally, it's different. It's a 10% commission, but player keeps his full $100 and team pays agent directly. Agent gets $10 from team, player keeps his $100. Team ends up paying out $110. So that's the primary difference. In the States, player pays agent. Overseas, team pays agent. So that's the business model in terms of how agents and agencies make money, just in terms of player contracts. This is not going into marketing stuff and all the other stuff that you can do. Just in terms of player contracts, that's how you can make money. In terms of the overseas market and the world generally, it is a rough and tumble world. It is a rough, rough world where European agents, for the most part, this is not 100% airtight true. In my experience, you have some talented American players who are making money and playing well in whatever country. They will have European agents all over them all season long saying, I can take care of you better. I'm over here. Who is your agent over there? All the stuff you would say, I suppose, right? What they obviously overlook is, all right, well, where were you 3 years ago when I was coming out of college? The only reason I'm here in the first place is because of the strong relationship I have with my agent and the vision that he and I have had this whole time. And now I'm playing well in this gym because that vision is coming to fruition, right? So, that for me, players switch agents all the time. But for me, that is really important when I hear of agents, European agents trying to steal players. It's like, well, where was this guy several years ago, right? How can he says he can help you now. What kind of vision, what kind of planning, how much substance, how much weight do you put in that, given that he waited for you to blow up before he showed up, right? What kind of sense does that make? In terms of working with partner agents in different countries, what I have learned over time, I know agents all over the world, and a lot of them are good guys, and a lot of them are crummy guys. A lot of them are like guys that I just described. For the most part, again, I don't mean to be like overly controlling or a control freak or whatever else. I prefer to just deal with teams directly because at the end of the day, if there is some problem, the toilet doesn't work, player is not playing enough minutes, there has been an injury, and now he needs surgery or some sort of rehab or therapy. I don't want to play whisper down the lane with three other people before I get the news. I want to talk to the GM and sport director directly. I want to talk to the player directly, and I want to talk to the head coach directly. So for that reason, I try to do these deals and have very strong relationships with coaches and sport directors. Sport directors is the term for GM of international teams. And teams directly, as opposed to kind of outsourcing that job to partner agents. I don't mind partner agents. I don't say I'm never going to work with partner agents, but I greatly prefer to just deal with teams directly. And again, that's like a whole other podcast. Like I could go on and on riff on that for a while. Different agents feel differently about that. I know different agents have different business models. I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm just saying I've been doing this long enough that for me, that's where I feel comfortable and that's my sweet spot. I have a partner agent over in Asia who I really like, who I rely on all the time. I have a partner over in Italy that I like, that I rely on all the time. Like this is not an airtight, zero sum 100 zero game, but for the most part, where I am in my career, I know enough coaches and front offices that I just like to do it myself, and kind of cut the middleman out.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there, and the points you made are valid. I mean, I say all the time, I preface it with like I have some of my I would consider best friends slash colleagues in the business that are agents abroad. Great guys, but there's a difference
Totally.
between that and then also understanding the business model. And I guess kind of this explanation into a question I have for you out of curiosity is, for me, it was always easy to take the strategy of like, look, I'm investing my time, my money, I'm boots on the ground, I'm shaking hands, I'm having coffees, I'm learning the markets, I'm there, I have the relationship. So why would I cut that commission in half? Right. Now, there are obviously situations where you can, if somebody adds value, then great, that's another conversation. But for me, then it goes taking that mindset into the actual business side of saying, well, how can I do this and be the direct contact, which I want to be, but also scale the business? Because then you have to think about, well, it depends on what level the players are. Okay, if I have 10 guys that are in the second division of Spain and they're making $2,000 or $4,000 a month, depending on where they are, like that's very different than having three guys in the first division of Japan. Right. It's very different. And so, I'm just curious on your thoughts on like how you balance the scaling, the scaling opportunity.
Well, certainly the two go hand in hand, right? And it's like what I'm trying to say is it's not that I'm trying to cut guys out or
For
partner
sure.
agents out because of the money. It's more just my preference of like having that direct communication in terms of solving problems, right? So the answer, I mean, all I can say is nod my head yes to everything that you just said. In terms of scaling the business, you've got to do what you can to maximize your profits. And in situations where you don't feel like a 50-50 commission split is fair, when this quote unquote partner agent makes one call at the beginning of the year and one call at the end of the year, all I can say is nod my head and agree to that, of course.
Yeah. Again, I think it goes from the agency perspective in hand. It's like, well, at the end of the day, you're only as good as the talent that you have, right? And so it's like you need to continue to recruit players that, you know, do well on the floor, but continue to increase their value in contract size, and then your business will grow the same.
No question.
So another topic with abroad for you is, and I know you feel strongly about this, and a topic that comes up a lot is, well, what are the best leagues abroad, and can the best teams abroad play in the NBA and vice versa? So can you talk a little bit about the talent level between, let's just say, generally speaking, abroad, like maybe some of the best leagues? And obviously there's many topics of best leagues, best talent, or highest contracts, but really just talent abroad versus, let's say, an NBA team or even a G League team.
Sure. So the best leagues internationally tend to be like, they tend to correlate to like the budgets, right, that they have. That's not always the case. Like the teams in China have enormous budgets for the two or three American imports. But that's a kind of a wild style of basketball, because a lot of the domestic Chinese players are not as good as the domestic Italian players, the domestic Turkish players, the domestic Spanish players. So I would say teams from Western Europe, for the most part, teams in the ACB in France and Pro A in, or the ACB in France, the ACB in Spain, Pro A in France, Serie A in Italy, the BSL in Turkey, those are probably, I mean, a lot of the best teams in those leagues are the teams in the Euro League, which is the highest level of international competition outside of the NBA. So the Euro League is, you know, consists of about 18 or 19 teams. Is it 18 or 19? I forget. Anyhow, the point of the matter is the best EuroLeague teams could absolutely compete with in a 5-7 game series with like non-playoff NBA teams. No question about it, right? But after you drop down from the EuroLeague, after you drop down from maybe the top 6 or 8 Euro Cup and Champions League teams, those are the two other really prestigious international competitions. So after you drop down from about the top 25 or 30 international teams, this is just my opinion, I'm sure I'm going to catch some heat on this, other than the top like 30 European teams, I would argue that most G League teams would beat most European teams in terms of where the G League is going right now with talent. They have added a third two-way contract. So these are three, you know, fringe NBA players, you know, swing players between the NBA and the G League. And then in addition to that, it's only, you know, 10 additional guys, five of which are going to be on Exhibit 10s, where you get a $75,000 investment, you know, from an NBA team. So let's just say right there, 8 out of the 13 players on a G League team in any given moment have NBA money in their pocket, because an NBA team is thinking, if things go right for this player, I could see this guy at least starting his NBA career as guy 12, 13, 14, or 15 on an NBA team. So when 8/13 of any G League team are fringe NBA players, I would argue that pretty much any G League team would do very, very well in any European league and pretty much against any European team other than the top like 25 or 30 teams in all of Europe. I am a big believer in how talented and how specialized NBA players are. And now, you know, going to the mid-2020s, in terms of what the G League is and where it's going, the best G League players, the best G League teams, I think they would all be monsters in Europe, pretty much across the board. Again,
yeah, I mean,
that's just one man's opinion. I assume some of my European friends and Chinese and Asian friends are not going to be happy about that, but that is my opinion. Having watched a lot of NBA, a lot of G League, and a lot of both high level, but also a lot of mid level European basketball, that's my opinion on it.
I agree. I mean, I agree for the most part. And there's, of course, there's going to be cases where, you know, maybe a team that's not in those top 30 can compete, or for whatever reason has a lower budget. And very, but the one fact that I think people overlook is that those two-way players, if you just think about the salary they're getting, which is 50% of the league minimum, it's like, you know, there's not, I mean, I can count on my hands, right? Like the EuroLeague teams that can even offer that type of salary to those players that would go over there. So it's like, oh, okay, well, you give up the EuroLeague type of level to go play in the G League. That means you're pretty special, right? So even that argument, I think, is very powerful.
I am happy to have this debate with anybody who wants to have it. There are pros and cons on this. My opinion is not 1,000% airtight. It is just the opinion that I've come to after watching a lot of, as I've said, high-level European basketball, but also mid-level European basketball, as contrasted to pretty much any NBA G League team, that if you look up and down the roster, you will see probably 5, 6, or 7 combinations of McDonald's High School All-Americans or first or second team power conference players at the NCAA level. And, you know, those types of players are hugely impactful players in the G League, and in my opinion, would be hugely impactful players at the Euro Cup or Euro League level from pretty much day one. They have to adjust. You know, the European game, the game in the ACB is not the same as the G League Ignite and Overtime Elite and so on and so forth. Yeah. I understand that. But from a pure size, length, athleticism, talent standpoint, you know, I would say almost out of the gate, half, if not more than half, of really good G League players are playing at the tippy top of European competition, if not in year one, by year two, pretty much across the board.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would, I think it would be an interesting debate amongst a lot of the professional, whether it's agents or coaches or scouts. I think it would be really interesting. So let's
the conversation, just one last thing on that. The debate I had with a scout who I saw at a game the other day was, how would an Exhibit 10 All-Star team do? Not two-way players, like the best of the next level down. An Exhibit 10 G League All-Star team of 12 or 14 guys, how would that team do in the EuroLeague season? My guess is they would do really well. Yeah. My guess is they would do really well. So, again, I think I've probably pissed off a fair amount of people, you know, east of the Atlantic Ocean. But in that way, that's my opinion. And at least as of today, I'm sticking to it.
I respect it. I like it. So, but what I want to say is I want to rewind a little bit. You kind of mentioned, you talked about like the, you know, NCAA Power Conference, but I want to rewind even before that. So when you're scouting and analyzing and evaluating players, whether they're in college for you to sign right away, or just kind of being aware of, you know, like the top high school players or players going into college, what are some things that I guess, A, you look for, that, you know, are now on your radar, and or B, traits that you see players having that makes them a successful pro, let's just say abroad, because I think it's a little bit different versus the draft prospects. Like, yeah, A, what are they, what are the things that they do that make you put them on your radar? And B, what makes a player successful as a pro when you're watching them in high school or college?
Actually, two very easy questions. On the radar is, you know, I can't give you all of our like secret sauce in terms of course, like, how and why we recruit guys, right? Talent, production, teams being successful, players being successful, right? We start with a list every year of probably like 50 or 60 guys that by like July 4th, and certainly by August 1, we're already talking to the coaching staffs and putting the feelers out and kind of getting the ball rolling a little bit. Now, that's a malleable list. We'll come off the recruitment of some guys for whatever reasons. We will add guys for other reasons. But in terms of how do we start recruiting a player, I mean, again, I'm not going to give all of the details there to a T, but it's, you know, a combination of individual success, team success, and then also certain attributes that we think will translate immediately, not after 2 or 3 or 4 years, immediately to the pro game, either in the States or abroad, right? Whether that, again, 3-and-D prospect, shop locker, bulldog, lead guard, you know, obvious stuff like that, right? In terms of what is the most important thing in terms of projecting out a successful European or G League or NBA player, it is the simplest question of all time. Do you can love it? Do you love it? A very easy question that sometimes guys mess up at these pre-draft interviews, and I talk to front offices about this not infrequently. They'll have a room of 6 people. It's all intimidating. You feel like, oh my God, there's the GM of the Denver Nuggets. This is getting pretty intense. What do I do? What do I say? They'll ask invariably, what are your hobbies? There is only one answer to that question. I have no hobbies. I literally wake up and I go to the gym. I get shots up. Like, they want 50-year-old men who are GMs and head coaches of these NBA teams, these G League teams. They have dedicated their lives to the game of basketball. They want the same in prospective players and prospective employees. And it's the same in Holland. It's the same in Japan. It's the same in Spain. I am not saying you shouldn't go fishing. I am not saying you shouldn't, whatever, be into music and whatever else. You have to do things outside of the main thing that you do, professional basketball. But if you don't love practice, if you don't love the grind, if you don't love the fact that, for at least a year of my life, I'm only going to be playing one game a week in a league that might be slightly under the level I should be playing at for the purpose of elevating my second year, which will in turn elevate my third year, because I am down for this grind for 8 and 9 and 10 and 11 years. Unless you are a lottery pick getting Gatorade and Pepsi money from day one, you have to absolutely positively love it and be down for the grind. That is the by far most important ingredient of anything. When I talk to a player that we're recruiting and their family, and so on and so forth. Now, there are other obvious, in my opinion, signs of what can make for a professional pro. Like, are you okay living away from home, right? Are you a punctual, professional, courteous person? What people think is that, oh, I'll get 20 a game and I can act like a jerk and show up late to things. Buddy, you will be packing your bag and coming home faster than you can slap a dead tick. You will be home by Halloween. In a season, if you are not an employable person, in addition to being an impactful player. So it's just personal, qualities, characteristics like that. But it starts with, do I absolutely love it? Where I am turning my alarm clock off in the morning, thinking about getting shots up, and I am just out of a hot shower at 11 p.m. after getting some more work in or film work done at night. You've got to be obsessed with it, in my opinion. Or you being obsessed with it, tends to lead to there's a direct correlation between that and successful pros, in my opinion and experience.
Yeah, I mean that was a great answer, and I think you're right. It goes it definitely goes for players, they overthink it. It's like they're looking for an answer. Even when you're getting recruited to college, now it's a little bit different. Okay, a lot of people say they want well-rounded individuals, and obviously marketability, that actually does play a factor with NIL, which is a whole another topic we didn't even get into. But yeah, I mean, do you love the game? Are you going to put in the work to become the best player that you can be to help the coach win games? Because if not, they're going to go with someone else.
Period.
Very, very
Period.
simple.
And like, that's a really up and like there's nothing wrong. If I'm recruiting a kid and he says, you know what? I just graduated from a Patriot League school, an Ivy League school, whatever. I'm gonna go to Wall Street. I'm gonna go to law school. That's awesome. Have an awesome time. Go kill it. I will call you in 5 years and hopefully we can partner up and work on some cool projects. But in terms of you being a professional basketball player and what we do in our shop, we are not interested. But keep my number, I'll keep your number. Let's be cool, let's be friends. But you should not enter this world if that's what you're thinking. And that's fine. That's totally fine.
It's good advice. It's good advice. Well, speaking of advice, as we start to wrap up here, what if there are some aspiring agents listening, what would you recommend them do in terms of, I don't know, events to go to or content to study or what path would you recommend them taking as a young aspiring agent?
Start with your relationships with NBA and G League and overseas teams. It's kind of like a chicken and an egg thing where I did it the wrong way. I started with players and breaking film down and figuring out, what worked and what didn't and what translated and what didn't. And then I'd sign these players and I'd be like, oh, wait, I don't know what to do now. And this is like 12, 13, 14 years ago, right? Start with it's the relationship business that we're in. We're just headhunters. Our clients just happen to be taller than most other clients in the headhunting business, right? Start with your relationships with front office and coaching folk and scouts and whoever else, where once you have those relationships lined up and they trust you, they trust your eye for talent, they know you know what you're talking about, they know you know the game, so on and so forth. Start there. And then once you start recruiting players, you can talk with some substance about your friend with the Rockets or your friend with Donar Groningen or, the scout that, with the whatever Sioux Falls Skyforce, right? Those are the relationships that are our stock in trade. And not only will I think it'll make for a more persuasive presentation when you're recruiting a young man and his family, there is substance behind that, obviously. Sign with me, and we now have a game plan for the next 2 months about how to get you on an E10 with the heat and get you up to the Pentagon with the Sioux Falls Skyforce ASAP, right? I have that relationship in my back pocket. No promises, no guarantees. But when I call them, they pick up. And I cannot wait to call them and say, I just signed John Smith. We've been in touch about John Smith for the last 6 months. I now represent him. Let's work together to getting him a pre-draft workout and then hopefully signed into the Heat organization and up to Sioux Falls. So start with the front office and coaching people. Get those lined up first and then start recruiting players, signing them and going from there so that you've got your next step all mapped out once the signing of the players happens.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I'll just piggyback on that and say, as I've said before, it is relationships. So if for whatever reason you try and you email and you show up to events and you can't have those relationships or a lot of them, build relationships with players, build relationships with, it doesn't really matter. Build those relationships on one end because you said it is a chicken or the egg. If you happen to build a relationship with a kid in sixth grade that ends up being the number one player in in the country, that
The
helps
Heat are
too,
going to call
right?
you back in that scenario, right? There is no right answer
Exactly.
to this, right? It's like if you rep LeBron, right? Like the Mavericks are going to pick up your call whether you know Nico Harrison or not, right? Like that's a reality, right?
Correct.
But in that way, my advice, having done this and kind of creating it out of scratch all those years ago, have your house in order, have your ducks lined up from a placement standpoint. After once you sign a player, have that plan already set in stone. So that once you sign the player, you're not scrambling to then figure out what to do next.
Great. Man, well, this has been awesome. I know if you're listening, there's a lot of gems in there for aspiring agents, for aspiring pro basketball players. Go back, listen to it again, check out Duncan's company. Before I officially let you go here, I do have to put you through what I call a sports business lightning round. So I just ask you some quick questions, and the first thing that comes to your mind, you got to hit me with. Ready?
Let's go.
All right, what's your favorite color?
Blue.
Do you prefer coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Pizza or pasta?
Tough. Pasta.
Would you rather be able to speak to all animals or speak four languages fluently?
Four languages fluently.
What's your favorite country outside of the one you're in right now?
Italy.
What is one of your biggest strengths?
Following up with people.
Who is one of the first people to really believe in you?
Darian Mack.
What's one of your biggest fears?
Heights.
I've got two more here. If you could have dinner and drinks with anyone in the world, dead or alive, who's one of the first people that comes to your mind? I'm sure there's many.
That is a good question. Robert Peace.
And last one, if you could turn back time and talk to 18-year-old Duncan, what would you tell him?
Be Penn's manager with Fran Dunphy and Steve Donahue and all those guys back in the day.
That's a good one. Well, you passed the flying colors, man. This was awesome. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your expertise and giving your perspective from now the 13th agent that has been on the podcast. So appreciate it. And yeah, I'm sure I'll be seeing you here soon in the gym somewhere.
Kevin, I appreciate your time. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks again for listening, my friends. If you enjoyed the episode or if it brought you any value at all, it would mean the world to me if you could give it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. If you share it on social media, make sure you tag me at Kevin Tarka. If there are any topics that you want me to dive into or any guests you'd love for me to have on the show, just shoot me a message and I will do my best to make it happen. Have an amazing day and hope to see you back here soon.